Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Dr. Ashley Mader, sex therapist, educator, and consultant, here last year, is returning to Love, Lust, and Laughter just as our nation is opening up more and more. And I really love Dr. Ashley because she has so many insights, among other things, on finding and keeping love. So we're going to talk about successful dating at any age, actually, at any age. We're going to talk about that because we are opening up more and people are facing this. So it's current. Hello, Dr. Ashley Mader. It's so nice to have you back.
Hello, it's great to be back. This is one of my most, this is a favorite topic of mine, is to talk about dating, whether it's with friends or with my clients. I absolutely love this topic, and I think it's a perfect time to start talking about it.
Well, it really is, because a year of isolation has many people feeling socially awkward. So, you know, I think that we can talk about ways that we can help them. And I think one of the first ways, I'm going to start this by saying this, and then you're the guest, and I really want to hear what you have to say about after a year of isolation, how do we begin to get back in? I think if people decide that they're emotionally ready, and maybe to be emotionally ready, they need to also get rid of maybe the pandemic hair, get a new haircut, or
yes,
get rid of those sweatpants that you might have been living in for a while, and maybe get some great, I know these are superficial things, but they can go a long ways to making a person feel more fabulous, maybe with a new outfit or two. And I think enjoying the fact that we're going to have a lot of adrenaline flowing because everything will be new again. We can go to restaurants. We can be across the table from and have another human being across the table. And how do you think people can just enjoy life unfolding again after this year of isolation?
I think it's good to start out slow, knowing that no one has to rush into anything that they're not ready to. But if people are ready to kind of get their feelers out to start dating, I would start small, as in, like what you said, like having to get a haircut, or get a couple of new outfits. It sounds superficial, but those things can make someone have better confidence. I also think maybe a start would be if you really have been, isolating and you haven't really been out in public, start out small, going out with just friends, going out with a couple of people, maybe out from your pod. A lot of people podded up. I know I podded up. And just going out with those people, just to kind of see how you feel about being around strangers again.
I think that's an excellent idea. Most people do have pods, and then they're beginning to expand them, of course. It is pretty exciting to, as we can travel more and get out there. But I think what you're talking about, don't rush into anything and go out first maybe with people that you're more familiar with. This can help a lot of people. I have a client who is self-described as an anxious introvert, and he happens to be really uncomfortable about getting out there again. I suggested that he might just pull back a bit on his expectations, and just say that. Just the next couple of months, say, go online, do online matching as a way to, as a way to motivate you to get out into the world, because we've had this dynamic world shift. And so just use online dating as a way, not necessarily to find the love of your life, but just to begin to get out in the world. What do you think about that idea?
Oh, I think online dating, and I think is one of the best ways to meet people. I think it's so interesting. Around maybe, was it 15 years ago, it was almost, there was a stigma about online dating. People wanted to kind of lie about it. I met my partner online, so I think it's a great place, and we've been together for 10 years, but I think at one point there was a stigma, but not anymore. About every one of my clients have at least tinkered around with online dating. And they have, you know, with varying success. But I think in general, though, I look at online dating, like in dating in general, people are going to have varying success in dating in general, whether that's online or not. Like I look at, what's the difference between going out to a crowded bar and meeting someone? What's the difference between that than surfing online on these profiles and swiping left or right? I kind of think it's kind of similar. It's just different.
Yes, and especially people over 50, it is apparently for the online dating sites, the largest demographic for all of the online dating sites are people over 50, because they know that that's the best place to meet people, especially over 50. You're not likely to, even though the bars in many states, I guess in most now, have opened up again. But still, it's not, and also you don't have all of the information that you can get from online dating about the person. So,
and I look at it as if you're online dating, ideally. I mean, there's different, and I've looked at some of, there's so many different sites now, and there definitely are like the typical hookup sites. But depending on what site you go on, one of the most popular sites, and it still is for long-term relationships, is still Match.com. And
that's how you met your partner and how I met my partner, now husband, Match.com.
So I mean, I'm a big, like, proponent for that site, but I was kind of looking at some of the online sites and did a little bit of research, and Match.com is the number one dating site for long-term relationships. And I think if you are going in, like, setting the intentions of, like, you know what, I'm looking for a long-term relationship. Hookups are fine, but, like, I want a long-term relationship. I think you at least know that when you're going into a site like that, everyone may be looking for the same thing. So there might not be that guessing game like there might be if you go out to a bar.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I think being out in the world and emotionally open is good, but most people find that online dating gives them the greatest choice of people that they wouldn't have met otherwise. And that's absolutely true. I would not have met my now husband, Brian, if it hadn't. I would have never met him. There would have not even an accidental meeting, I don't think, if it hadn't been for Match.com. And I think their algorithms must be really great, because we are so compatible. And same as for you and Stephen, we're about 10 years in.
Yeah. I mean, because we were both looking for the same thing, and we are definitely very, very compatible. So somehow they're all, like, algorithm really works, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So I also wanted to talk about how we can widen our dating pool by narrowing our demands. But some people think that means that we'd be compromising or settling, and I don't see it that way exactly. Suppose you're with someone who does not check off a whole bunch of the boxes that you have, check, right? And this person might not share your love of travel or baseball, for example, but suppose the person really gets you and doesn't judge. This is likely to be a person who actually wants to hear about your day. So is that settling? I don't think so. I think you might have found a.
I think people need, I mean, I think it's obviously, I don't, I think people, everyone needs to have standards. But I think there's a difference of, I think you can have like, you know, you can call it your big three or your big five. Like everyone, some people have things that are non, like negotiable. Some people, you know, like smoking might be something, something, other things could be like politics. Is a huge one for people. That's what I hear all the time. Is just, and that's what, like maybe religion. So you can have your, whether you want kids or you don't want kids, those big value things that can actually really change your life. But I think it's sometimes good to date out of your comfort zone. Like let's say that you have a type of look that you always go for. Try dating someone completely different. Like I'm not saying again, like don't go against like your standards. You want to, you know, like of your basic standards. But you know, if someone's really into sports and you're not, and they're like, oh, that's a deal. Well, try it out and see. I think it's good to kind of, you know, just kind of expand your horizons a little bit.
Expand your horizons. Exactly. The anxious introvert that I was referencing just a bit ago, and he was told by somebody on an online date that he could expand his horizons if he, and that actually put him off a little bit. Even though he knew that it was true, but he got more nervous about it, so I you know I said, look at your expectations and maybe adjust them a little bit.
Because no one's going to be perfect, and no one. The thing is, like, if you want someone who gets you in every single way possible and is a perfect fit, you might as well stay single and just love yourself more, because difference is kind of what makes the world go around. You learn, like, anytime you, like, for even if you meet a new friend that has a different interest than you, you're going to learn from that friend. And I think it's the same thing in romantic relationships. They might introduce you to a new musician that you've never thought about, or a new way of cooking, or, you know, a new traveling trip. So I think it's important to expand in that way, because it's, you can learn from each other.
Absolutely. And I think that if one of the relationship litmus tests is because of being with this person, am I a better person? And if you can answer yes, then you need to stay with that person, because you're growing from you're growing. We have these mirror neurons, as you know, in our brains, and so they reflect back certain behaviors and ways of thinking and being. And so we can actually grow as people in a relationship, I think, better than if we're alone. We can really grow in a relationship, particularly if we're with somebody who can challenge us in some loving, caring ways, and can really listen to us, as I said before, and not judge us. I mean, these are big things.
Yeah, you learn. A person learns more from being in a relationship, how to be in a relationship, than being, like, if you really want to know how to be in a relationship, if you kind of have to be in a relationship to learn that. And I talk a lot about, you know, we've talked about differentiation of self and being able to validate oneself. But that doesn't mean that a person's a lone ranger. That means that you can learn to do that with someone else. You learn about conflict resolution. You learn about communication. You learn about self-soothing and not projecting onto your partner. All those things you can easily learn that by yourself. It's a challenge to learn that when you're in a relationship, but it's an important challenge to learn.
It really is. And some people have an easier time when they're over 50. I mean, you specialize in older adults, but you're a younger adult. I'm a way older adult. And so I sort of know this from life experience. I'm not saying you don't know from life experience, but you can, when you are living it out, it somehow becomes even more clear. But so a question that some of my older people will say, well, in dating is, well, how do you know if it's right? And so I think that people that are over 50 can often say, let's be monogamous for a while and see how we work together.
Yeah.
And I call this a try a relationship, try it. And it doesn't take very long because, again, people over 50 often find out very quickly whether this person is right. And a colleague of mine told me this. Older people get better at catch and release. I like that.
That makes sense. I like that.
Yeah. Older people are better at catch and release. So you try the relationship and see if it works. And if it doesn't, you release.
Yep.
Let it go.
And I think a lot of my younger clients, and I think maybe everyone maybe can fall into this, but I hear this a lot from my younger clients, is the anxiety about the future, already jumping ahead in the future after like the second or third date. And I'm always like, you know, just stay present. Because if you are falling in love with the future, you don't know what's in front of you.
You know, that is very true. And when we were having our, I call it the pre-interview, but it's also a chance to just talk to you on the phone, which was nice. You gave me such a good litmus test that I'd love for you to expand on it for our listening audience. So because some women in particular worry, if I have sex on the first date and he doesn't call back, will I be okay? So that's the question that the woman needs to ask herself.
Yep,
can you expand on that,
yes,
Ashley? Because I think it's a great litmus test.
So, yeah, I think it's, and I tell this to, I came up with this when I was in my early 20s dating, and then I've used it with clients. So if you're on a date, I always, like, think, you know, when you're talking to this person, you know, like in the middle of the date, whether you want to excuse yourself to go to the bathroom or if you can make that assessment, right? Ask yourself, okay, I'm really feeling this person, but if I have sex with him tonight and he never contacts me, if it's just truly a one-night stand, am I going to agonize over this? Am I going to feel horrible about myself? Is this going to just weigh on me? And if the answer is yes, don't sleep with that person that night. If the answer is no, like you're just, you know, you're feeling, you know, like amorous that night and you're just, you know what, I just need to have this one night stand and I don't care whether I hear from this person again, go for it. You know, use protection and, you know, go for it. Sow your oats. But if you really think that if you don't hear from that person, that it's going to up your anxiety, and you're going to, like, every time you're, you know, like your text message goes off, your phone rings, you're like, oh, my goodness, it's going to be that person. Just don't sleep with that person. It's not worth that stress. Just get to know them a little bit more.
Yes, and one of the things, I think a silver lining of the pandemic was that for many couples who did date online and didn't meet right away, instead used Zoom or the phone, but usually some kind of digital visual thing, the courtships were longer. And I have a client who is in his, who's around 40, and he met his now, so this was a year ago, his now serious girlfriend online, and but they had a long courtship before they even met in person, and That was because of the pandemic, and it really worked for my client because he's an introvert, but not necessarily an anxious introvert that I described before, but an introvert and appreciates getting to know somebody a little more slowly. So these longer courtships, I think, were definitely a plus for many during the pandemic, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm a firm believer, kind of like the tortoise and the hare, slow and steady wins mm-hmm. the race. If you things that burn fast usually die fast. Not in all cases. There's always exceptions. Mm-hmm. Someone can say like, well, but like, I think things that burn fast can die fast. And I think it's just important. I think that slow courtship, you're just getting to know a person more. And I also think those, you know, I call the feelings limerence. So those are, some people call them the new relationship energy. But when that new relationship energy is extremely high and your dopamine mm-hmm. levels and serotonin levels are super high, it almost mimics a manic phase. And it also, like, I sometimes think some of those anxious butterflies, some of them are good butterflies, but some of them mm-hmm. might not be good butterflies. And those actually might be more red flags. If you are so anxious every time, yeah. like, is this person going to contact me? And, like, you get super high when they do contact you. And is that more of an anxious attachment? Are you anxiously attaching to someone? And is that a big red flag that this relationship is going to be a cat and mouse game the entire time? And do you want that in your life?
Yes. And people that come out of anxious attachment in their because of their mother and their father and or the parenting when they were little, they're much more likely to have this anxious attachment and just want to maybe be dependent and cling. I'm generalizing here, but there's some truth to this, that they'll cling more readily because they didn't have the secure attachment as a child. So they're eager for a relationship, but sometimes a little too eager, and that can put off the other person.
Yeah, and I think I've been kind of thinking about this a little bit more with some of my clients, but I sometimes there's an energy that I think there's that anxious energy of like I want to attach to someone that some people put off, and a mm-hmm. lot of people can sense that and don't want that in their life. And so I think that's something, if you're entering a dating scene extremely anxious, like anxious to partner up, you mm-hmm. might be putting different energy out there that energy might not be extremely attractive to others.
Because it comes across for sometimes as the person being very needy mm-hmm. And clingy, even.
Yeah.
Wanting too much. So it kind of comes under the heading of codependency in relationships, in actual relationships. And I suggest to my clients that if they're serious about somebody that they're dating, they need to think about the differences between want and need. And I think it's healthy to be able to say, I want you even more than I need you. You know what? I can live without you, but I can live better with you.
Yeah.
So that's important. And we're back to differentiation again, aren't we? Which you and I spoke about last August on the air.
Yeah, and I think that's there is a difference between need and want. I look at it like a want is like, I choose to be with you because you do add something to my life. A need mm-hmm. feels more like if I didn't, like, I need you, but I need anyone who's going to give me this attention. It's different.
That's yes. And so it doesn't feel, it's not going to, the other person, if the other person is at all intuitive, they'll pick up on that.
Yes.
I just need somebody who'll give me some attention, right?
Yeah.
And that isn't very attractive for if you're on the receiving end of that. It feels too sticky, too needy, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing too, what I find, and I think this is just what happens, a lot of times the needier person ends up with someone who does kind of like the push away. And so there is that, like I said before, like a cat and mouse thing. And it just, it sets both people up for, you know, the term that people use now is ghosting. Like getting ghosted and then just feeling really sad. And I think just being very aware of what you're looking for and what energy you're putting out there in the dating scene.
Yeah. And, you know, I really, just a second, take a little sip of water here. We were talking about, your litmus test of having sex on the first date, and if he doesn't call back, will I be okay, is the question that you ask. I think if you're over 50, it might be even a little easier to do this, to negotiate the sex, because, you know, I believe, and I'm living it, that it's possible to have the best sex of our lives after 50. And, of course, by this I don't mean movie sex. I mean the more intimate, collaborative sex. And, you know, you and your partner work together. You tell each other what you can and can't do. And so it's more intimate and more caring. And lots of couples that I work with, if there's a problem with erectile dysfunction, for example, or an overly dry vagina, if the woman hasn't been on bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, which I've been on for quite a few years, and it really works, if you go that route, and it's great sex, and it can be outer course, everything but intercourse, if yes, people have those problems.
Absolutely, I think that, and I think a lot more communication sometimes happens. That's something I learned in my dissertation research, is that older adults, like, and I did more, my research was more 65 and older, they tended to communicate about sex a lot more than younger people.
Yes, say more about that. That's been my experience too. So tell me about that with your clients and or your research.
I think, well, from what I found is they are more aware of if they have any like physical ailments that might be causing some sexual dysfunction. They have become very comfortable talking about that, and they want to share that with a partner. I think the other thing too, if someone's been together for a really long time, if a couple has been, there might just be an ease in that relationship of talking. I think people just get more confident in themselves.
I do agree with you, and also what I have found is that I'm so much more aware of my mortality that indeed there's a limited amount of time that I have left with my husband, and we're really good at growing and renegotiating things, and we just don't have much conflict because we resolve it so quickly, and I think need to be forgiving of each other's flaws, and I think sometimes older people can do that more readily. But, you know, we've experienced a lot of life, maybe a divorce or two, illnesses. So we've had losses, and we've seen some difficulties in life. So with any disagreement or anything annoying, an annoying habit, I think you have to ask yourself, especially if you're over 50, although this is a good question really for any age, how important is this particular thing compared with the relationship I have?
Yeah.
And yeah. Happy couples tell me over and over, I let it go. Let it go. And the nice thing about letting it go is that when you're in a sexual, when you're making love with your partner, you can let go in other ways too, really let go, and the orgasms are much more likely to be there, maybe even multiple orgasms, because you're letting go. So yep. Letting go is a good thing to do at any age, really.
Absolutely. I think letting go, and I think a lot of any person that I have worked with that has orgasm difficulties, if it's not related to something biological like medication, it's about them having a difficult time letting go.
Yeah, that's been my experience too. So I think it could be useful for our listening audience if they're thinking about going back online now that we're opening up and we can see people in person and not have to wear a mask if we're fully vaccinated. So the main question is, what am I looking for in a relationship? That's got to be the first question. Do you want companionship or fun or good sex, a committed partnership? What do you want? And I have found that in counseling singles, that is a very useful question for them to think about. What do I want in a relationship? And
I think a lot of times an individual will want a certain something, like this is what I want in a relationship. However, they are dating contrary to that, and they wonder why things are not working out. So I think it's really important to know what you want in a relationship. How do you want to date? Are you, if you are just looking for hookups, there's definitely apps for that. If you're looking for something long-term, there's basically an app for any type of dating that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's online dating has expanded so much. My last husband before this one died very suddenly, as I've mentioned on the air a few times, in 2000. And I wasn't ready to date for about a year, which is fairly typical. His death was so unexpected and sudden. And with Charlie's sudden death, I thought about maybe doing online dating, but I didn't do it for about 2.5 years. But I remember in 2000, Match.com was at its infancy. It was one of the first online datings. But now, and then I did online dating with Match.com and what was the other one I used? eHarmony. Mm-hmm. And that's also there. A lot of people like it because eHarmony people are very serious about a real relationship, but also they don't like it that there's so many questions. But in order to use the site, but it does perhaps make the aligning and the mating more regular. But online dating worked for me for 10 years until I met Brian, and I'm glad I persevered.
Yeah.
Because, there were some duds along the way. And but I would always say, I've got to kiss a few frogs before I find my prince.
Exactly. And I think that's important. Like, it's just like any type of dating. Everyone's going to kiss a few frogs before they find their prince. Like, I think it's the same thing. If people are like, who's online? A lot of great people are online. And, in my experience of dating, the people that I have met, like, I have some duds that I met in real life as well.
Oh, of course.
So I don't really think that it makes, I think, you know, there's going to be people that you're just not compatible with, whether you meet them online or organically. It doesn't matter.
True enough. So I also give my single clients who are maybe wanting to date again and want to fill out a profile. Sometimes I'll help them with a profile. But in order to find out what you're really looking for in a relationship, you need to think about, well, I've got this. How many of the following qualities do you want in a partner? And so then the list that I have, and I give this to my clients, is adventurous, articulate, compassionate, confident. Now, they're to go through the list and circle what they especially want, right? Creative, determined, easygoing, funny, honest, independent, intelligent, optimistic, sexy, and perhaps and possessing a high libido might be true for, certainly would true for me. I think that you need to think about what qualities you want in a partner, and then think about, do you also possess those qualities?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, what's your best quality? And you can use what you've got to get what you want, really. Think about the last time you were turned down for a date or disappointed on a first date. Were there any things that you could have done differently? And this is an advantage for single people that are in therapy because they can run this past the therapist.
Absolutely.
And if you can learn how to broadcast your best qualities, you'll get more out of what you want in life, and you'll get turned down less. Don't you think that's true? If you really know how to broadcast your best qualities.
You have to know what your best qualities are, and you can't look for someone to complete you. So if you're if you're looking for these qualities in this person because it's something that you lack, well, what can you do to build those up in yourself and then have someone that complements you rather than that someone that you are kind of projecting those insecurities or what you lack onto?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And self-images can be deceiving. You know, I think if you think about how others' perceptions and your perception, so how somebody might perceive something and how you might perceive something, how are they different? And so I have another little quiz that I give my single people, and I give them a list. And so they're supposed to circle words that they think would describe how other people perceive them now, and then make a check by the same word you believe portray how you really are. So I have, this is my list: happy, secure, warm, inadequate, caring, distant, scared, sad, angry, giving, insecure, unhappy, bright, naive, handsome, homely, attractive, trim, fat, compassionate, playful, shy, confident, anxious, lonely, clumsy, talented. Well, that's quite a list, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if you can go through the list and circle how other people perceive you, now that's useful, how you think other people perceive you. And then you go back at that list and, again, how you believe you portray how you really are. And then you have a list of some things you might want to work on, either talking to a platonic friend or a therapist. We're probably, you and I are a little bit biased about therapists because we have a lot of training and we can be more objective. The problem with talking with friends is they'll often just side with you and make you feel better.
I really like that because I wonder how many of what people are putting out in the world and how they're feeling internally, how much are those aligned? I always look at the self that we lead with in certain situations. Is that our real self or is that our pseudo self?
Yeah. So if it's our pseudo self, then we're not being authentic and if we're telling little white lies and presenting things that aren't really true, we're going to be found out eventually, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Or it's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. Because you have to keep track of... I suppose that's why a lot of relationships, 3 months in, people often present themselves really well for the first 3 months. And then they
yep.
ease up and some of their true self emerges.
They can't keep up the pseudo self for over 3 months. That might be like the cap.
It'd be like the what?
It's like they can't keep their pseudo self up for over 3 months. It's like it's a cap. It's like, okay, like it's like your real self is going to squeak out.
Yeah, I think that's going to happen. I think it often does happen. We can't keep up the good behavior all the time.
So, yeah.
And so that might even be a sign that you need to do some work on yourself. And sometimes you can do that in a relationship and those mirror neurons, and you can grow in the relationship and talk and maybe do couples therapy together. But if you're a single person without another person as a possibility, then it's really time to, I think, to do some therapy. And I'm so glad therapy is more available to people now because we can see people with all these digital means and lower fees for some people. And so I think it's a good thing. Don't you?
Well, absolutely. And I think to kind of piggyback off what you said is that, you know, if you're a single person, if you've noticed a pattern in your relationships, a lot of times there's a patterning that can be pretty apparent if you think about it, because it's just like, you know, people will say like, why do the weirdos or the narcissist or whatever, name whatever, like that pathologizing characteristic. And they're like, why do these people keep finding me? If you start really thinking about that, it's like, I always look, it's like sometimes like, why is my picker of people off? It's like, what therapy can, a therapist can help you work through is like to point out those patterns. Like, what patterns are you repeating from your own family of origin? It's weird that we would like, it might be weird to think about that we're repeating patterns from our family in our current dating life, but it's often, or at least we're repeating the attachment styles. And it's really, if you start knowing that, you will pick different people in your life.
Yes, you will. And especially if you're really looking at yourself and noticing these patterns. That can also help with social anxiety, because lots of people have more than just shyness. They're really experiencing social anxiety, which is basically the fear of being criticized and rejected by others. And do you, Ashley, do you remember Lou Anne Brizendine's book, The Female Brain?
I know what you're talking about. It's been a lot, but I don't think I've read it, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, she first, this was 2005 or 6. She first wrote The Female Brain, and she's a psychiatrist and a neurobiologist out of UC San Francisco. So she wrote The Female Brain, and then she decided to write The Male Brain, and her colleagues teased her and said, oh, well, that's definitely going to be a slimmer volume. And, of course, it's not true, but our brains are different. But she explains, Luann Brizendine, it's Brizendine, and I do recommend, her books are still available in paperback, and they're really good. What she explains this way, human survival once depended upon popularity. We relied on our clan to provide food and protection, so our brains evolved to be sensitive to the way other people see us. So that's why we have social anxiety. Social anxiety can create a fear that every action is scrutinized with a critical eye. And, you know, it could have something to do with the hypervigilant fear system in the amygdala part of the brain. And I think that the amygdala, which is the fear center, the feeling center of the brain, I think it gets overwired when people come out of anxious or avoidant attachment. So what happens is the fight or flight modes are triggered. You get this red alert, meaning that anxiety is likely to come back the next time you're in a similar situation. So mm-hmm. that's a big part of social anxiety.
Absolutely. And I think that's especially after, like, not being, if you're getting back out in the dating scene after not dating for over a year, that social anxiety easily could be triggered.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that. You know, and then what people can do in therapy with social anxiety is to confront the fears. And then when you confront the fears, they're easier to handle. And research shows that people with social anxiety tend to pay more attention to threatening information. So they really have to retrain their brains to home in on positive information. You know, maybe going out and picking out, now we can do it, we don't have the masks on. Well, some people do, but the fully vaccinated people don't have masks on typically. And so we need to pay attention to friendly faces. Go out and look at friendly faces, or go to a party on time and start some conversations, or know what's going on in the world and prepare a few topics of conversation in advance. These are all strategies for social anxiety.
And I think of it as all of us and the entire world have had this global collective trauma. We've all experienced mm-hmm. it. And I think, I never think that trauma bonding in a relationship is a good thing. Like, it's not necessarily, but I think in this case, it's a really good starter conversation. I know it sounds so weird to say, which vaccination did you get? But that is a starting conversation now. It's a different time, I had a small gathering at my house yesterday, and some of the topics of conversation were like, what were the last things and social things that you were doing before everything shut down? And people, like, it's one of those things that people actually really enjoy talking about. It's just, like, and it's interesting to hear what other people's experiences were. And so I think, there's a built-in conversation that we all have in common.
Yeah. So what did you hear at your party? What were some of the examples of, I love that question. What were some of the last social stuff you did before the shutdown?
I was in D.C. at a training, so I talked about that and how when I came back, I did not, honestly, I think with, like, a lot of people, I did not think Corona was going to be a big deal. I was like, whatever. Like, I just didn't really think about it. And then when I flew home and everything started shutting down, and my close friends didn't want to be around me because I just got off of a plane.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is a big deal. Okay. Other friends, I had a couple of friends, a lot of my friends are professors, they were on sabbatical in Australia, and they had to fly back because her mom was really ill and she was the only one that could like get out. And so she had to like cut her sabbatical short to go stay with her parents in DC live with them for 3 months. You know, other people are talking about just like, oh, like one of my really good friends, she's like, I remember us going to the movies right before everything shut down. And that was, and like what movies we saw. And so it's just really interesting. So we all talked about that in different ways, what our experience was of it, how we were internalizing it, how some people like my partner knew it was going to be a big deal once it hit Italy. He's just like, oh, this is bad. And where I was just like, eh, it's going to be okay. And it wasn't, obviously. He was right. He's a scientist. I am not.
And he's a professor, so I'm not surprised you had professors at your party.
Of course. But yeah, that's usually, So it was just really, it was just fun to kind of hear, to reminisce about that, because everyone had different experiences, but the same experience. So I think it's a really, I think we're going to have that conversation. And then everyone are just talking about, oh, did you have a side effect of the vaccination? What were your side effects? Everyone has these, I know it's a weird way to start, but I think everyone is talking about it.
Yeah. Well, sure. And what it gets people talking and feeling like, hey, this is how it used to be. This is a little more normal. I'm looking forward to, I'm going to go, a lot of listeners know I'm based in Seattle, and Dr. Ashley is based in Massachusetts, right? So,
yep.
But in a couple of weeks, my husband and I are going to the Bay Area, and I'm hosting a family luncheon of a little over, well, I don't have the final count, but it'll be just right around 20. And I'm hosting it at a hotel, and it'll be so good. I have a cousin's child who I haven't even seen yet. The last time I saw her, she was inside her mummy. So it's going to be really great, and I thought that we might go around the table and ask what was a kind of a silver lining for you?
Yes.
In the pandemic, what came out of it for you that either changed how you are or made an adjustment how you are, changed how you see something? Mm-hmm. Silver linings can be very instructive if we allow them. What do you think about silver linings? And did some of your guests yesterday experience that, the silver linings?
I mean, I think we all talked about that. I think a lot of people, well, and I think if you were, or if someone's anxious trying to go back out in the dating thing, I think, and you're introverted, I think a lot of introverts had similar silver linings of not having obligations anymore, and how great that felt of not having obligations, because some people overcommit themselves, and being able to kind of cleanse your life of things that are not important. And I hear that a lot from people, how they're like, I cleansed my life and I don't want to go back to that fast paced way of living. I'm happier. Or other people, you know, might have found a new hobby that they never realized they had. Like, for example, I started crocheting during the pandemic and really learned how to crochet.
Did you?
And I've crocheted a lot, and it's my new little hobby. Other people I know started baking. Some people, you know, decided to, I think a lot of people, if you were going to the gym every day, people got their own home gym so they didn't have to waste the time commuting to the gym.
Or if they could even get into the gym. So many gyms were closed.
Exactly. So I think it put a pause on people's lives and to really reevaluate what is important and what's not.
Yes. And what the word that heads that up is prioritizing.
Mm-hmm.
And we could I reprioritize some things too, and Well, the thing that kept me on task and with my husband's help was getting the book published. And it was a year ago that we published the book, my book, Love in the Time of Corona. And I'll just spend a second plugging it again, because even though the subtitle is A Sex Therapist's Advice for Couples in Quarantine, it still has a lot of good information. And I must say that Dr. Ashley, on her website, did a review of my book. And her website is OurShine.org.
Yes.
Right? Our, O-U-R, OurShine.org.
Yep.
I'll put this in the show notes. Yeah,
and
that was very, very kind of you to give such a good review of my book.
Well, it's an excellent book, and I think obviously we're coming out of quarantine, there's still some really important lessons to learn in that book for couples, whether you're quarantining now or not.
Yes. Thank you for saying that, because I think it's true. And as one of Dr. Mark Schoen said, and it's on the back cover of the book, it's a year's worth of sex therapy in one volume.
Yes.
And so we are close to the end here, and I wanted to tell our listening audience that Dr. Ashley Mader will be back for a part two on the 27th of July.
Yes.
So please tune in for that. We haven't decided on the topic quite yet, but I'm telling you, with Dr. Ashley, I can talk about anything. And I love it that she's a younger person, because she's so very accomplished and has a particular point of view that maybe that's newer. And her blog is called Shine, and that stands for Sexual Health in a New Era.
Yes.
So, again, the website is OurShine.org. And so I'm really glad you're coming back on the 27th, and we always have things to talk about.
Yes.
Don't we?
Yes, I'm looking forward to it, because we always have really great conversations.
We do. And so I'm thinking that Rodney, our producer, will no doubt put the music on any minute. I try to kind of wind this up toward the end. Think about some of your expectations about getting out there and really evaluate them, as Dr. Ashley and I have been discussing. And maybe listen to this program again and take some notes, because there's some good information here about strategies that will help you when you start to get out there. And there's our music. Speaking of the music, thank you again, Ashley.
Thank you. It's been great.
Great conversation. Look forward to doing this again with you on the 27th of July. Please tune in, everybody, and thanks for listening this time. Remember, have some fun. Bye-bye, everybody. Da-da-da, happy feet. Da-da-da, happy feet.